Is it Mr. Finley? Good morning to you. You may approach. Mr. Liss, you're here today. Do either council have any questions before we begin? You may proceed, Mr. Finley.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice. Your Honor, my name is Bogan. I represent Anthony Voteries in regards to this appeal, which comes from the district court's denial of my client's second amended motion for post-conviction relief. Mr. Voteries was convicted of first-degree murder back in 2015, sentenced to life imprisonment. To give you a little procedural background, in the case, in April 23rd, 2019, he filed a second amended motion for post-conviction relief. In June of that year, the state filed a motion to dismiss that matter. And in July, Judge Dirk from the Douglas County District Court ordered briefing in the matter, requiring the state to submit a brief on September 1st of 2019. They failed to do so. On the 29th of October of 2019, my client filed a motion for default judgment that was ultimately denied in January of 2020. And in July of 2020, his second amended motion for post-conviction relief was ultimately dismissed as well. Now, I submit.
Counsel, earlier, I guess it would now be last month, September 3rd of this year, we released an opinion in State versus Britt that I think says there is no such thing as a motion for default judgment in this context. Are you familiar with the case?
I have not read it closely, but nonetheless, my client filed the motion for default judgment in regards to that, and submits that there was nothing statutorily that barred him from it. I argued that, and I will submit to the court based upon my arguments and his motion. But I acknowledge the court's ruling in regards to Britt. Thank you, Judge.
Okay.
I did, however, write a great deal on the merits of my client's motion for post-conviction relief, 65 pages that I submitted to this court. But I do think the starting point has to be an argument that was made by the state that my client's motion for post-conviction relief was not verified. I want to, again, point to pages 455 and 456 of the transcript in which my client, you will find my client signed the document himself. It was signed in front of a woman named Kelly Ward, who presumably is a notary at LCC, where my client was housed. That was executed at that time. Miss Ward, presumably, and then I have nothing to the contrary, and I don't believe there's anything in the record to the contrary, witnessed that signature of my client. He then signed additionally a certificate of service attesting to the fact that it was a true and accurate copy that he had then sent to the Douglas County Attorney's Office.
What does verification mean in Nebraska?
I struggled with that. Chief Justice Hevigan, the problem that I have with verification is the statute does not provide a clear definition for it. It doesn't provide a form for it. It doesn't tell us exactly what it is. I look at the series of cases that this court has produced as to verification, and while we've referenced verification, how it appears, I can't speak to. So I just have gone, well, first I turned to other jurisdictions, Texas and Louisiana particularly, but more importantly, I turned to custom. The custom is that when we sign a document, whether it be a check, contract, the brief that I submitted to this court, I attest to what the writing in it, that is my words, that those are my thoughts, that is my signature, that I am who I say I am. And that's exactly what Mr. Burries did in this regard.
It is a verification. Well, I guess maybe I'm asking you something you already told me you don't know, but I want you to assume for purposes of my question that historically in Nebraska, a verification consisted of two different types. One, that the person was who they were and that they verified that the content of the document was true and correct, either a positively verified being it was true and correct, same as an affidavit, or upon information and belief, which is a simple verification. We're missing anything, aren't we, in this situation about verifying that the content of the document is true and correct?
Justice Castle, I think we would not be having this conversation if a short sentence was written above my client's signature saying, I verify the contents of this document. But I submit to the court, and I've argued to the court a lot in my brief, that the statute doesn't require that. This court hasn't directly required that. And so I think we go back to custom. We go back to how documents are executed. And please remember, and I know
that, let me ask about that, because I don't disagree that you have to look at what the practice was. But in 1965, when the Post-Conviction Act was adopted and required a verified motion, every pleading in civil cases had to be verified by a different statute. Wouldn't the statute, it wasn't the term verified, verified, a term of art that was well understood by the legislature when they adopted the post-conviction statute?
Conceivably, Judge, but I think we verify documents every day, and we don't require that attestation type language before we do that verification. So while I understand the argument as to term of art, and again, I think it would be easier if we had that short snippet, we have not required that either as a court, as a jurisdiction, or statutorily by our legislature. That is, it would be so simple if that is all that verification required. Then why don't we just put it in the statute? Why don't we put it into prior jurisprudence? It's because I think that the custom says that all you have to do is make sure that you have signed this document. And in this case, he took the extra step of having it notarized, so that we know that he signed that document. And when one signs, and I give the examples that I've given previously, when you sign a document, you attest to its contents. I do want to say something though, Judge, is typically in these cases, not typically, but oftentimes, these post-conviction relief motions are filed by pro se individuals, and they are looking at the statutes. They may not be privy to the term of art that you're talking about. They certainly may not be looking back in 1965. They may not have been born in 1965. And if we tax them with the requirement that they're going to have to know that term of art, as opposed to the custom that they've been living under for perhaps their entire life, I do think that's onerous. And I do think that's unfair. And I think when a man signs his name and has it notarized, and that was a purpose, he obviously, as the court I'm certain knows, when you get a notarization done in LCC, NSP, any place else, you have to take some steps to do so. The reason he took that step is because he wanted to verify. He wanted to follow the statute as best he could. He's reading the cases that this court has put forth, and all it says is verification. And he goes, okay, I am who I say I am. This woman's attesting to who I am. Isn't that verification? Because that's more steps than I typically take in any other walk of my life, any other document that I've signed. That's more than enough. And I, Justice Castle, I have to agree with him. I think that that is more than sufficient. Hence the reason that I argued in the manner that I did during my brief.
And I suppose you would concede that if we disagree, that's the end of that.
Yes. When Mr. List wrote the way that he did, he wrote very well. That would be the end of the argument. I submit to you. I would definitely concede that, but I just don't think that under the totality of these circumstances, under the arguments I've made, and under the facts as they exist in our record, that can be the end of the argument. I just don't think the law supports that, and I don't think equity supports that. Maybe I will just sit down if I may, Your Honor.
Well, at some point in time, Mr. Finley, can you address what happened down in the district court? What did...
I can. Ultimately, and the reason I did the procedural history that I did, and it's a lengthy one, is there was a lot of moving parts in regards to the procedural history. And so if you wanted me to start at the post-conviction stage...
Well, you don't. What is the reasoning the judge used to dismiss the second amended petition? Or maybe I misunderstand. Maybe he didn't dismiss it.
I think he did. I think he did in July of 2020. The fact is that he didn't give any indication as to why, whether it was simply a matter of factual insufficiency on his part, or if there was some procedural defect that he found that I certainly don't see from the record. I can't say, because the order itself from Judge Durr is so brief that we just don't know what the reasoning is behind the dismissal of that.
Doesn't he seem to say that he gave your client an opportunity to file a third amended complaint and your client didn't, so the judge was going to dismiss the second amendment?
I still think amended complaint. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Your Honor.
Is that a valid reason to dismiss the second amended complaint?
No. And the reason is because that was as I've just discussed with Justice Castle, I think that was an appropriately filed motion that needs to be ruled on its merits. If the court gave leave, and leave means you can choose. You can either stand on your present motion or you can file a third amended. My client had no intention of filing a third amended motion. He didn't ask for it, and nor did he indicate that he was going to be filing it. Judge Durr gave him that opportunity, and I believe that it's permissible. It was not an order. It was not a demand that he file further pleadings in regards to this. He simply stood on his filing from 2019. He had put a great deal of time into it. As you will see from the transcript, it is a fairly lengthy document, and he stood by that document and the words in it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
And please support Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. Burries raises two overarching claims on appeal. We maintain that he's not entitled to relief on either. As far as his first claim regarding the denial of his motion for default judgment, this claim is resolved by this court's recent opinion in State v. Britt, which held that a court has no authority to grant a default judgment in a post-conviction proceeding. Britt is dispositive on this issue and illustrates that Burries is not entitled to relief on this claim. As far as the second claim regarding the denial of Burries' post-conviction motion, we maintain that Burries' post-conviction proceeding was properly dismissed due to his failure to comply with the court's directive to file a third amended motion. As set forth in our brief, a district court has discretion in adopting reasonable procedures and conducting a post-conviction proceeding. And in this case, the court was justified in ordering Burries to file a third amended motion in light of all the filings that were pending all at once. Burries' pro se filings made it clear that the second amended motion was not complete, that he wanted to amend that motion, and that he was objecting to that motion being considered until it was amended. In light of these filings, as well as all the other confusion surrounding the entire proceedings, we submit that it was reasonable for the district court to direct him to file a third amended motion. This was not an abuse of discretion in our view.
Is giving someone leave to file a motion directing them to file a motion, is that equivalent?
I would submit that it is in this case. In certain circumstances, perhaps not. But here, where you have someone objecting to the motion on file, saying it's not complete, saying they want to fix it, and asking for leave to file a new one, and then the court granting that motion and laying out the timeline and procedure for doing it, we would submit that does amount to a procedure in this case, or a directive in this case. I apologize.
Mr. Finley has just told us that his client stood on the second amended motion. He didn't want to amend it further. What's your response to that?
Well, that doesn't work in this case in light of everything that he had done up to that point. It basically left the district court with no option here. I mean, he's saying, hey, my second motion is no good. I need to fix it. My attorney screwed it up. I want to file a new one. And the court says, okay, go ahead and do it. He says, no, I'm not going to do that either. Just give me a default judgment. The court can't give a default judgment, so it has to do something, and we would submit it was justified in dismissing the proceeding due to his failure to file that third amended. It's well established that a court does have inherent authority, aside from any statutory or court rule, to dismiss a case for lack of prosecution. Here, Mr. Burris is well aware of the court's order granting him leave to file the third amended motion, and he expressly declined to do so. So we would submit the district court was justified in dismissing the post-conviction proceeding on that basis. Additionally, as noted in our brief.
Does Mr. Burris then have the option of filing yet another post-conviction motion?
You mean a successive post-conviction motion after this is completed?
Yes.
Well, a person's always entitled to file successive motions. The question is, are you entitled to relief on that? It's going to depend on timeliness. And of course, you know, are you raising claims that were or
guess
or
what
could
I'm
have
asking
been raised?
Is, does he have an opportunity at some point in time to have his post-conviction argument heard on its merits?
I anticipate our position would be that his successive post-conviction motion claims would be barred, given that he could have did or could have raised them in a prior post-conviction proceeding. So our position, I anticipate, would be that no, that the claims are barred in the event he comes back with a successive motion and attempts to raise those.
Because they're untimely?
Well, it
or just
probably would be untimely. I know he was awfully close with this one, but and it might have even been done to days, if I recall correctly. But I think you'd potentially have a procedural bar in place there as well, due to him being having the opportunity to raise him in this proceeding. Our second or alternative argument in this case is that even if the second amended motion did remain in place as the operative motion in this case, it wasn't verified as required by the Post-Conviction Act.
So let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Finley. What does verification mean in Nebraska?
Well, I don't think it's been it's spelled out as clearly as it could be. I mean, generally speaking, as Justice Castle pointed out, I mean, it's going to require some sort of attestation that the pleadings or the allegations are true and accurate. When you look at Black's Law Dictionary, it defines verification as a formal declaration made in the presence of an authorized officer, whereby one swears to the truth of the statements in the document. I think that's consistent with what our case law generally requires. When I looked at other contexts, I saw the case on the statute dealing with writs of mandamus, and there the statute says that those motions need to be done by affidavit. This court has construed that to mean that you can do it through an affidavit or a verified motion. So it seems to me that they're somewhat analogous there, at least in terms of the content and what we're requiring. And I would note that, at least in the context of mandamus, this court has held that the failure to do so is jurisdictional. So that's a fatal defect. And in this case, we would submit that given that the second amended motion wasn't verified, that would be a fatal defect. And even if that remained as the operative motion, the district court would have been justified in dismissing the post-conviction proceeding on that basis as well. I don't have much to add to my brief beyond what I've said here today. For either or both of these reasons, we would maintain that the post-conviction proceeding was properly dismissed and that Mr. Burris is not entitled to relief on this claim.
If a post-conviction motion is not verified or it looks like this one, can or should a district court give leave to amend to give the move on to chance to add a verification?
I mean, they certainly could in terms of whether or not they should bring that up sua sponte and offer that up. I guess I don't really have a position on that. I mean, but I think if, especially if the litigant caught it and asked for leave to amend it, it would be up to the discretion of the court. And if the state hadn't responded at that point, I don't see why a district court wouldn't allow somebody to just file a new motion and fix that and add the verification. I wouldn't see any problem with that. And I assume most district court judges would. I don't know why you would deny them that opportunity to do so. But that didn't happen in this case. And I would note that both the first motion in this case filed by Mr. Pribivar and then the initial amended motion by Mr. Burris did contain verifications. So he knows how to do it. The motion he himself submitted contained a verification, but the subsequent second amended one contains no such verification. And we would respectfully disagree with the appellant's position that mere notary is sufficient. We disagree. The statute requires that it be verified, not simply that it be signed or notarized. And a notary is not equivalent to a verification. A notary is merely someone attesting to the authenticity of a signature. It's not a verification as to the truth and accuracy of the allegations. And we think that's material, especially in the post-conviction context, because we look at all of that, and if the pleadings are, we assume them to be true, and if true and proven up, then you are entitled to relief. So the pleadings have to mean something in terms of whether we're going to move forward with having the evidentiary hearing, appointing counsel, et cetera, et cetera. So the verification does mean something. The statute requires it. The legislature's aware of that requirement and your opinions interpreting that requirement. So we submit that it means something. It was not complied with in this case, and it was a fatal defect. If there are no further questions, I would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Finley and Mr. Lips. You are excused. And as noted, State versus Keagle has been put off to our next oral argument session. So the court will go to State versus Betancourt Garcia, and we will be joined. Justice Funk is recused from this matter. We will be joined by Judge Masteller from the Douglas County District Court. And